food inflation, an emergency in Haiti. In the Pacific, salmon and their fishermen are disappearing quietly. The Pope visits the faithful and the wounded. At a forum on compassion, Democrats gouge away at each other's eyes, politely. And 20 years ago today, war in Afghanistan was center stage. And guess what? It still is. Never surrender. It's The Takeaway.
All across the USA, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. Today we're looking at economic problems, John, that are just bubbling up all over the globe. The housing bubble is not just bursting here in the United States, but it seems that the problems are quickly spreading from Ireland to India. Not good news at all, and we're going to take a stab at trying to understand why. And there's no let up on the global food crisis.
It's a difficult country, and only God can probably help us around here, but the president cannot do nothing.
That's in Haiti, where food riots have left 7 dead in the past week. Things are so bad, the Haitian parliament's trying to fire the country's prime minister.
Ouch.
But on a better note, one sure bet economically, you want to guess what that is?
I'll leave it to you.
Gaming. Video games. Seems people are holding on to their Xboxes and companies are making money hand over fist.
Of course they are. In other headlines.
We have to put our money where our mouth is. Now. So that we can put food into hungry mouths. It's as stark as that.
That's World Bank head Robert Zoellick, who says the rise in food prices could push 100 million people in poor countries deeper into poverty. The International Monetary Fund believes that hundreds of thousands of people are at risk of starvation. Delta and Northwest are talking today about a merger. Together, they would be the world's biggest airline. Still to work out are details with their pilots. No guarantee the deal will move ahead.
Asian markets fell Monday. The drop follows a poor performance Friday on Wall Street as the markets reflected the poor U.S. economy. And more violence in Afghanistan this morning. Taliban militants attacked a police checkpoint in Kandahar. 11 policemen died in the latest assault against the nation's police force. And on Sunday, 2 NATO soldiers were killed and 2 others were wounded in another attack.
Kenya finally has a power-sharing deal after violently disputed elections in December. President Mwai Kibaki has named opposition leader Raila Odinga prime minister Sunday. The agreement resolves a political crisis, in theory, that has left more than 1,200 people dead. The Dalai Lama is visiting Seattle in a week of spiritual leader visits. The Dalai Lama said Sunday that Tibet cannot make any more concessions to China. He repeated his request for the government to end suppression in his former homeland and withdraw troops.
4 months after he had a tumor removed from his back, such a great story, Trevor Immelman is celebrating his win at the Augusta National Masters. He is the first South African to earn the coveted green jacket in 30 years, and he also blew Tiger Woods' chance of a grand slam this year.
Tamed the tiger, that's
Tamed
for sure.
Tamed the tiger.
So, everybody got their taxes done? Sure you do. Sure you do. No, you don't. Procrastination. That's your homework assignment for today. Let's talk about stories of procrastination. If you have your taxes done, you probably still have some procrastination stories to share with us at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. You're done, right?
Well, not sort of. Yeah, it depends on how you count done. What about you?
We may even get to reading your responses on the air if we don't procrastinate too much.
Right. I think everyone can relate to that.
Indeed.
No one's perfect all the time.
Well, I am a lot.
No, you're not, though. See?
Actually, quite a lot.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, provoking discussion about what it means to do the right thing.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
It's tough times, for homeowners here in the United States, and it seems that the problem's spreading.
This is the Radio Newsreel. It's a contagion spreading around the world. It started in America, but now no modern country appears safe. Millions of people fear that they or their loved ones could be the next victim.
That's not a real newscast, John, just in case you were wondering.
I love this program. We scour the world to find imaginary news to bring you.
But it really could be. It really could be a newscast because the U.S. housing crisis, it seems like it's contagious. Economists say problems are cropping up all over the world. Let's take Ireland, for example. They're having a problem there where the real estate boom was on a 16-year run. Prices, say experts, are 30% higher than they should be. What does this mean? Well, like thousands of Americans, buyers there are left with mortgages that are higher than their homes are worth. The New York Times' Mark Landler's covering the story. Mark, how is the housing situation here affecting what's going on overseas?
Well, it's making matters worse. In some of the countries like Ireland, which you mentioned, they already had a major problem. They had a huge oversupply of housing, and their housing bubble actually popped before we had in the U.S. the subprime problem. But what the subprime problem did is basically create a credit crisis to go along with a housing oversupply. So now you have too many houses, and banks are no longer giving people mortgages in places like Ireland and Britain. So what were pre-existing problems are now made much, much tougher for these countries.
And you make a point what I thought was just fascinating. Britain's mortgage debt is higher than in the United States. And
Britain's mortgage debt as a percentage of its total economy is higher, not by a great deal. And by the way, that's true of a couple other countries in Europe as well. The Netherlands has an unusually high percentage of mortgage debt. And usually this is basically in every country that has a fairly well-developed and sophisticated mortgage market, which Britain, you know, really does, probably the second best after the U.S., you've seen this tremendous growth in credit. And that, of course, is extremely problematic now when the credit standards are being tightened and banks are beginning to turn people down.
What's interesting about that, too, is Britain is really not the worst of it in Europe. Ireland, as we mentioned, but also you talk about Spain.
Yeah, Spain, maybe from a supply point of view, may be the worst off of all the European countries, because what you had in Spain was a combination of a lot of immigration, people coming into the country, foreign workers, and then you had an absolutely huge holiday market where you had people from Germany, Britain, even Ireland, who had a lot of money because their own housing prices were rising, were investing in and building vacation houses on the Spanish coast. And in Spain in the last decade, there have been 4 million housing units built, which is more than Germany, France, and Britain combined. So what you have in Spain is just a huge oversupply of housing at a time when the economy's slowing. The same mortgage problems that are happening in the U.S. and Britain are happening in Spain. And so, you know, there's a country where they could have a correction that's much tougher than what's going on in the U.S.
And you add on top of that that there are some estimations that unemployment in Spain will go from 8.6 this year to 11%.
Well, the housing market accounts for a huge percentage, relatively speaking, of the Spanish economy. Residential investment, something like 12% of the total economic output of Spain. You know, by comparison, it's 5% of Britain and 4% of the U.S. So when you have a standstill in construction, which is what they have now, you're talking about thousands of people in the construction industry being laid off. These are also, by the way, the foreign workers. Many of them are the foreign workers that came into Spain because these were very well-paying jobs. And one of the issues that both Ireland and Spain worry about is if these workers decide there's no reason to stay in these countries and go home or go somewhere else, it will further depress the housing market.
That's interesting. You know, Mark, one of the things it seems to me we're experiencing here, and I wonder if you agree or not, you know, we've heard that the banks are globalized, that the sense of risk and the ability to lend money is a kind of a global phenomenon because banks, you know, conduct business cross-border all the time. I'm wondering if what we're seeing is a kind of a manifestation of one of the effects of that, as suddenly real estate value has no sort of local meaning. It's really connected to a kind of global sense of risk and value, and that it's hard to live in your little community and be insulated from these kinds of things.
You know, it's true that it's magnified that effect, but it's worth noting that previous downturns in the property market have been international in nature, and the reason for that is not actually dissimilar from what you said, but the root cause of most housing bubbles is easy money as measured by interest rates. And in general, when the Fed cuts interest rates as it did at the beginning of our upswing in housing, many other central banks followed, the European Central Bank, even central banks in Asia. So what you had was a global easing of the money supply, which then created these bubbles more or less coincidentally. And then, as you say, the whole household finance industry and the credit industry has globalized.
Well, we're all in the same bloody boat then,
Mark,
right?
We're all in the same boat. Yeah. It got expensive for the same reasons, and it's plunging for more or less the same reasons.
Well, thanks for joining us, Mark Lenley of the New York Times, on housing as a contagion sweeping the world.
What I was saying is that when economic hardship hits in these communities, what people have is they've got family, they've got their faith, they've got the traditions that have been passed on to them from generation to generation. Those aren't bad things. That's what they have left.
In the last few minutes of this segment, let's review the bidding in the latest episode of the Democratic Party's presidential dismemberment contest, shall we? The latest bleeder is Barack Obama, who has had to explain remarks he made about blue-collar workers clinging to religion and guns in hard times. The Circling Clinton campaign has called Obama's remarks elitist and out of touch. At a compassion forum last night in Pennsylvania, both candidates tried to stay polite, but the scars in this long contest are starting to show. Joining us now to talk about how a long campaign with this level of party division inevitably leads to damaged candidates is Nate Persily, a professor at Columbia Law School. I'm telling you, that was hard to watch last night. What did you think, Nate?
Well, he was, you know, trying to control the hemorrhaging, and this is the most recent chapter in the series of gaffes that either one of the candidates has made, and now they're trying to recover, but it's dominated the news cycle this time.
News cycle aside, is there something about the process here that really is ultimately going to be working against the Democrats in November?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question as to whether a competitive primary actually leads to a weakened candidate in the general election. It is certainly the case that it is often weak candidates who get competitive primaries because someone in their own party tries to pick them off. I think Barack Obama actually has become a better candidate as a result of this competition. If you look just at his performance in the debates, which was pretty weak before the, say, Iowa, since then he's done so much better. Nevertheless, the amount of money that he's had to spend, and for that matter Hillary Clinton as well, is much more than they would have expected had this been over in Super Tuesday. And more than that, there are these gaffes and missteps that have come up in the last few months, which will then frame the general election.
There's a quality as we go through this of desperation, it seems. Listen to this Hillary Clinton soundbite. I can't even describe it as soundbite. She's telling a weird little story in Valparaiso, Indiana. It's Clinton number three, Dylan. Play it for us, will you?
You know, my dad took me up behind the cottage that my grandfather built on a little lake called Lake Winola outside of Scranton and taught me how to shoot when I was a little girl. You know, some people have continued to teach their children and their grandchildren.
Hey, she's not baking cookies. She's blowing away squirrels, Nate.
Well, what Barack Obama described that as her Annie Oakley moment, right?
That she what? I mean, what is going on here?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is this shows a real window onto Pennsylvania politics because gun rights are a very big deal among Democrats in Pennsylvania. As James Carville once said, it's you know, Pennsylvania's Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Alabama in between. And those voters in the what's called the AIB region, Alabama in between, do care about gun rights, and they are swing voters. These are middle-class whites who have voted Republican or voted Democrat, and a lot of them take religious issues. A lot of them are pro-life. That's one of the strange things about Pennsylvania politics also, is how many Democrats are pro-life. So when you frame the issue in terms of guns and God, it is going to alienate some voters.
Professor, very quick question for you. Do you think that this is going to have legs? Is Barack Obama really going to suffer from this comment?
I think he will suffer a little bit, but he does. So long as he stays within 10 points in Pennsylvania, he doesn't really have anything to worry about with respect to the nomination. What I would be more concerned about if I were his advisors is the effect of that this has on framing the general election. Barack Obama's being portrayed now as a very typical Democratic candidate, whereas originally he seemed to be one who was breaching the divide between
right.
blue states.
Right. Quickly, Nate, professor of law at Columbia Law School, have you done your taxes yet?
Yes, just this morning.
Oh, man. Man. He's good.
You can email us at talkback@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 800-543-2543.
543-2543.
Femi Oki, you're here. What do you got for us? Headlines.
Asian and European markets are down today following Wall Street's tumble late last week on concerns over a slowdown in the US economy and the poor outlook for corporate profits. One in seven mortgage holders are worried that they won't be able to make their monthly payments on time over the next 6 months. This is according to an Associated Press and AOL Money and Finance survey. It also gives us a very vivid sketch of how the housing crisis is weighing on the minds of many Americans. The mothers of children removed from a West Texas polygamous compound are asking their governor for help. They've written a letter to Governor Rick Perry about their children who have become sick in custody and have been taken to hospital. Officials say about a dozen children have chickenpox. Japan's fisheries agency says that for the first time in 20 years, protest action against the country's whaling fleet has prevented it from meeting its quota. It caught only 60% of the whales it planned for research purposes and is due to return to port in the next few days. Now, here's a sound they haven't heard in Dakar and Calcutta for quite some time. Oh yes, that's the Dakar-Calcutta Express. Passenger trains are travelling from Bangladesh to India today. For the first time since 1965, that's when the service was suspended because of a war between India and Pakistan. Goodness me, I feel sorry for those commuters. Bangladesh was in the eastern part of Pakistan at the time. So we have a Dakar to Calcutta, to Dakar.
What's the ticket? What's the ticket price?
Oh, about...
Next time, get that the next
yeah,
time.
Yeah, I'll find
next
out.
I want to know.
I shouldn't make
dump
that
you
one.
On that one, huh?
Oh, it'd be about $1. I'll check with my sources and get back to you.
Yes. Well,
that's the news for now. See you later.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji. Produced in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Today we're following lots of stories. The global food price meltdown continues. Global housing crisis is growing. And we're also following what's happening in the U.S. presidential race. Healthcare is another one of our topics today. And John, American innovation is making other countries' healthcare better. Did you know that?
That is interesting.
The World Health Organization ranks the U.S. healthcare system 37th in the world. 37. And that's right between Costa Rica and Slovenia.
Kick their asses, man.
Right.
Yeah.
And on Frontline tomorrow night, journalist T.R. Reid travels across the globe asking, are there lessons from other countries' health systems like Britain, Switzerland, Japan, Taiwan, and Germany that perhaps the U.S. can learn from? T.R., the numbers are always shocking. In the U.S., 700,000 people go bankrupt each year because of medical bills, something that you discovered simply does not happen in Switzerland. Why is that?
Yeah, isn't that amazing? No other country lets that happen. You know how many people go bankrupt in Britain because of medical bills? Zero. Germany, zero. Canada, zero. Japan, zero. Other countries just don't let that happen because they've decided that medical care is a human right and society has to provide it, and Americans haven't decided that.
And so what did you learn as you traveled around and took a look at how other countries are dealing with their healthcare systems?
Well, the striking thing is it's not all socialized medicine out there. Some countries do have government-running medicine, but we found a lot of rich countries that have private docs, private hospitals, and private insurance. They still manage to provide universal coverage, and they all spend less than we do in the process.
So universal healthcare is not necessarily a dirty word in, say, Europe, as it is seemingly become here in the United States.
Yeah, isn't that striking? And I think, as I said, it's because Americans were in this thrall to this conventional wisdom that it's got to be socialized medicine run by government. And as a matter of fact, it's not. In fact, in our movie, I argue that Germany is less socialized than the U.S. In America, everybody switches to government insurance at age 65. In Germany, they stay with the private insurer for life.
All right, let's get to some of the details. One of the big problems that we have here in the U.S. is that companies are spending, or whether I should say, part of the problem is 25% of the cost of care goes to administrative costs. How do other countries deal with it? For example, in France, you say it's only 3% of the cost there.
Yeah, that's right. Isn't that amazing? You know, Americans always think that free market, competitive, private enterprise is going to be the most efficient way to do something. But as a matter of fact, our private insurance industry is the least efficient in the world. We spend more money on paperwork and in underwriting and stuff than all the others. The reason is, in the other countries, they've all decided that health insurance should not be for profit. And once they take profit out of the mix, the only reason for these insurance companies is to pay people's medical bills, and they do a pretty good job of it.
In other words, in some of those other countries, you have government that's setting the cost of medical care.
Yeah, in a lot of countries, there's a negotiation between the health ministry and the doctors and the hospitals to set fees. In some countries, though, this is done in the private sector. In Germany, it's the insurance companies, these nonprofit insurance companies, that negotiate the fees, but they do have a standard set of fees, applies to all doctors and hospitals, and the docs and hospitals have to put up with that in those countries.
So given what you've learned, you're very funny. You say that pizza we stole from overseas, American Idol we got from overseas, so why not borrow a few tricks?
Yeah,
but
exactly.
What do you think, but what did you learn would be some of the things that we would actually be more likely to adopt here in the United States?
Well, I think we can stick with private doctors, private hospitals, and private insurance. The one good idea that all the other countries have taken is they have one model and everybody's in it. America has 19 different systems. If you're 16 and poor, there's one system. If you're a veteran, there's another one. If you're 66, there's another one. If you have kidney disease, there's a separate one. All the others have everybody in one, which is much cheaper to administer and it's fairer to everybody. And then the second thing is, if you have private insurance, First of all, the insurance companies have to cover everybody, and they can't deny a claim in those other countries. And it's not a for-profit operation. It's basically seen as a non-profit operation, like Blue Shield and Blue Cross used to be. In fact, Americans invented non-profit health insurance, and then the guys making a profit bought up the companies because they saw a gravy train there.
But do you buy into that argument at all that the United States does, and I shouldn't, let me just ask this, does the United States have a better level of care than anywhere in the world?
If you're rich, absolutely, yeah. If you're rich and have insurance, you get the best treatment in the best hospitals in the world in our country. The problem is, you know, there are 40 million or some people who don't get care. According to the government, 20,000 Americans die every year because they can't afford to see a doctor. And in our film, I asked the health minister, how many people die in your country because they can't afford to see a doctor? And they kind of look like, you know, like you asked how many spaceships from Mars landed in the parking lot last week. You know, it just couldn't happen. They don't let
20,000. Wow. Very quickly, TR, what do you think, how is this huge problem, how is it playing out in the presidential nominating process we're under?
Well, healthcare is a big issue. I think most voters rate it as their third biggest concern. My sense is, so far, the candidates are kind of tinkering at the margins of a system that really needs to be fixed at the center. The other countries have universal coverage for less money because they made fundamental change in their system. I think that's what we need, and the candidates aren't talking about it yet, at least.
T.R. Reid, Washington Post reporter and Frontline correspondent, your show tomorrow night on Frontline. Thank you.
Yeah, please watch.
It's fascinating, you know, and it's great to be able to, you know, talk to these guys at Frontline to hear behind, you know, the amazing pictures that they deliver week after week. I mean, it's really, really great.
The numbers are definitely startling. Femi, okay, you're here with
Good
us
morning.
Again with the headlines.
Hello there. There was a meeting between the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C. this weekend. The World Bank comes out of it saying that the rise in food prices could push 100 million people in poor countries deeper into poverty. The International Monetary Fund has said hundreds of thousands of people are at risk from starvation. And they're off. American Airlines received clearance from federal aviation officials Saturday to return all of its 300 grounded jets to service. After 200 cancellations Saturday morning, American was running a full schedule by the afternoon with no cancellations, the airline says. President Bush is also being briefed on the airline industry later on today. 4 months after he had a tumour removed from his back, Trevor Immelman handled the wind and the pressure of Augusta National on Sunday to win the Masters. He's the first South African to earn the coveted green jacket in 30 years.
Femi, have you done your taxes?
Yes, I have.
All right, all right. I did mine. Bob in New Haven, every year I try to get my taxes in by April 15th, but every year I find myself panicking over unintelligible forms. Every year I have to file an extension. Poor Bob.
Actually, I filed an extension. Does that count?
No.
I mean, that's procrastination. Go to our website. Tell us how you're procrastinating. And we have a special application that actually tells how much it will cost you if you procrastinate on your taxes.
Oh.
Second to second.
Why is it costing you? Why is it cost?
Yeah.
No.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, provoking discussion about what it means to do the right thing.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
On this show, we've been following very closely the global food crisis, and every day there seems to be some new developments. Today, Haiti's parliament, or I should say over the weekend, they voted to dismiss Prime Minister Jacques Alexis following deadly riots over rising food prices. Sunday, a UN police officer was killed in clashes. Last week, four others died. Rioting has broken out from Egypt to Mexico. The World Bank has promised $10 million in food aid to Haiti, and its president of the World Bank, Robert Zoellick, has called on the international community to put their money where their mouths are and to rapidly distribute $500 million in emergency aid.
It's critical that governments confirm their commitments as soon as possible and that others begin to commit. Throughout the weekend, we've heard again and again from ministers in developing countries and emerging economies that this is a priority issue.
Raj Patel, UC Berkeley researcher and author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. Why has this crisis climaxed right now?
Well, at the moment, there's a perfect storm of reasons why prices are going through the roof. So the price of oil, for example, means that farm inputs are much more expensive. Demand for meat means that cereals get diverted away from the bowls of the hungry into the stomachs of livestock. Biofuels means that grains get diverted from food into, you know, into ways of burning them. And a range of other factors mean that the price of food has gone through the roof. Now, the reason it's strikes so hard is because the economies in which you're seeing these riots are very exposed to international markets, which is why I find it preposterous that Robert Zoellick is sort of trumpeting the cause of the hungry, when it was he, when he was the U.S. trade representative, and he, as head of the World Bank, who's been forcing liberalization down the throats of these countries. So that now when
liberalization
the
meaning...
I'm sorry, liberalization meaning that countries need to be... need to reduce their tariff barriers so that crops can come in without taxes, and need to stop stockpiling grain so that the market can work freely.
It's the old Milton Friedman argument.
It is. Yeah. I mean, it is, and this is what happens when you follow Milton Friedman. That when there is nothing between you and the price of food, these price spikes are communicated directly into the hearts of the poorest communities on the planet.
And you also talk about how it's our eating habits. You mean just in the United States, or are you talking about even, like, say, in China? You're talking about meat production, for example. People are consuming more meat all over the world, including places like China, than ever before.
Well, yes. I mean, I think that certainly the way that we eat today is unsustainable. I don't think there's enough food in the world. There's not enough land in the world to feed all the livestock so that everyone can eat at the level of meat consumption that Americans have. But that's okay. I mean, no one really wants to eat at the level that Americans do. I mean, the American children now have a life expectancy that's 5 years less than their parents because of the kinds of food that are in circulation here. I certainly
is
think that...
Is that true?
Yeah, it was in the Journal of the American
Medical
Association.
So my life expectancy is 5 years less than what my parents?
No. Your children now...
Oh, my... Okay.
...would be 5 years less than yours.
But even that's horrific. But let's get to what you think some of the solutions are ways to address this global problem.
Well, hold on. Can I just add a detail to the menu here?
Mm-hmm.
A little piece to the cuisine? All right. Paul Heichler, are you with me? Paul? Yeah, Paul's in Coos Bay, right off the Oregon coast. The sun isn't up, but you are. Paul, you are a salmon fisherman, right?
I am.
And you got nothing to do this year because the federal government has banned salmon fishing off the Oregon and California coast, right?
It sure has. And it's for good conservation reasons, but we are totally shut down off the Oregon and California coast and very limited off the Washington coast.
In 2002, they counted 775,000 adult Chinooks, and this year, 58,000 projected?
This is just for the Sacramento stock alone, Sacramento River in California. That's absolutely right.
Oh, my.
That's scary, Paul. What can be done about that?
Well, one thing, we're diverting tremendous amounts of water out of the Sacramento system, and in the last seven years, we've increased water diversions out of the Sacramento from 3.5 million acre feet. By the way, mostly for agriculture, for raising grains for animals, to 6.5 million acre feet, and we've dried up to and really modified the system.
Well, some people say that ocean conditions are also a problem up and down the coast. What's your alternative? Can you fish for something else?
My boat isn't large enough to really effectively fish offshore for albacore tuna, but I will. That gives us some options, and albacore tuna, of course, is we're competing with foreign fleets.
Right, and big boats with big machines. Well, Paul, thanks for joining us, and we're going to talk to you a little bit later in the season to see if you did have any success there with albacore.
Okay, and a little bit of rockfish, so enjoy your day.
All right, you too. Paul Heikkila there on the Oregon coast in Coos Bay. So there you go.
Yeah, so Professor Patel, I mean, it feels like it all feeds itself. All of these little mini crises are creating a full-blown dire crisis.
Well, yeah, I mean, and as I say, the things that would have insulated us from this, you know, things like, well, it's not so much us as people in developing countries. The things that would have insulated them from these kinds of price shocks and these kinds of crises of production have been whittled away. So now, you know, we're exposed to this ecological catastrophe as well as the economic one.
So what can be done? Give us some good news. Or what is being done?
Well, I mean, around the world, the people who've come up with the most creative solutions have been farmers, small farmers, family farmers, sustainable farmers, excuse me. And they have been saying, well, why don't we have we need a democratic conversation about food. We need to be able to get our food regionally. We need to be able to farm our food sustainably. And there is a range of local sustainable farming options that's available not just in the United States but across the world.
So you're saying we have a global distribution network that uses tons and tons of fuel, but we don't really have a good regional distribution network for local products.
Yes, and this is the interesting thing. When for example, Robert Zoellick talks about market access for farmers, farmers in developing countries say, well, we'd love to have market access. We'd love to access our own markets because at the moment we find ourselves competing with grain from the United States, or the European Union that subsidized to the tunes of billions of dollars a year. And what they're saying is actually we'd like to sell our own stuff to our own people.
Well, I'm going to ask you to hang on. Well, I mean, it's just such a big, we got to sort of talk about this in small bits. Otherwise, it gets just too big. Have you done your taxes yet?
I filed an extension.
Okay, Professor Patel, we're going to ask you to hang out for a minute.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, provoking discussion about what it means to do the right thing.
Listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Afghanistan. War in the Hindu Kush. A war fought by the Soviet Union to prevent the spread of Islamic fundamentalism.
Get that, to prevent the spread of Islamic fundamentalism. Well, we're still fighting that battle, and 20 years ago today, the Soviets announced that after nearly 10 years of a bitter, bloody war in Afghanistan, they were withdrawing their forces. And I say, and since we do in these segments look at historical events that I think set the table for what we're dealing with in the 21st century, one could argue that that Soviet withdrawal began
an enormous amount of what we're dealing with today, particularly the United States, in the Middle East, and in Afghanistan. First of all, the Afghan war, after almost 10 years, brought down the Soviet Union, and indeed, in the media, the Soviet-Afghan war is often referred to as the Soviet equivalent of the U.S.-Vietnam War. We should be so lucky. The U.S., after 9/11, has spent more than $5 billion in a largely failed effort to bolster the Pakistani military effort against al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And, you know, we are still in Afghanistan in an open-ended way, just as we were 5 years ago.
Where's Osama bin Laden?
Yeah, that's a good question.
That's one of my big questions. But the other thing is, obviously, the U.S. was involved in Afghanistan when the Russians were there, right? What
Absolutely.
Were they doing? They were funding. Who were they funding?
Well, Charlie Wilson's war.
Charlie Wilson's war.
To the movie theater and see the story of what became the blowback which produced the Taliban and the instability in Afghanistan, which is definitely the seeds for everything that we're dealing with today. The U.S. funded through President Reagan. And actually, you know, one of the leading experts on Afghanistan from New York University, Barnett Rubin, has a great sort of analysis. Barnett Rubin.
Now, the key decision was made by President Reagan himself, and that was the decision to continue to collaborate with the Pakistani military fundamentalist regime of Zia-ul-Haq to fund the Afghan Mujahideen, and that who included at that time the Arab radicals like Osama bin Laden, who were fighting alongside them. The result was the creation of an ungoverned space where the terrorists who attacked us on September 11th could establish their base and have now reestablished their base in the tribal territories of Pakistan.
So everything that wasn't done to deal with the withdrawal 20 years ago set the stage
for what we're dealing with today. Another thing that's kind of interesting is look at the timing. In 1980, Jimmy Carter was president. Summer Olympics was being held in Moscow. What did he say?
I can't say at this moment what other nations will not go to the Summer Olympics in Moscow. Ours will not go.
It just is interesting because obviously we have a lot of protests and controversy about China and the Olympics, and President Bush now is calling it simply a sporting event.
I guess, you know, if I look over the grand arc of this story, when I was covering this back at a local station in Oregon 30 years ago, really, Afghanistan was obscure. Today, Afghanistan is center stage in virtually all parts of geopolitics, and that's an extraordinary realization.
Okay, now I see what...
Listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji. Produced in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Tomorrow, American Catholics will be turning a page in an often troubled relationship with the Vatican. Pope Benedict XVI kicks off his first visit to the United States since assuming the papacy. The late Pope John Paul's U.S. visits were confrontational to U.S. morals and values, but John Paul's charisma and reputation as a Cold War freedom fighter ensured that he drew gigantic crowds in the U.S., especially with young people. Benedict has neither the reputation nor the charisma of his predecessor, and he is the first pope to visit since a widespread child sex abuse scandal rocked parishes throughout the United States. We've asked Laurie Goodstein, the New York Times reporter tracking Pope Benedict's visit, to talk about what the pope expects to achieve while he's here. So what are Benedict's objectives in this trip?
He probably has three audiences: American Catholics, Americans who are not Catholic, and also a global audience. He'll be addressing the United Nations.
And is there anything particular about the fact that he's doing services in New York and Washington that suggests he's sort of testing the waters in the United States for you know, presumably many visits to come?
Well, Washington because he has a visit to the White House, so he had to go to Washington. And New York because he has a visit to the United Nations. That's really the central purpose of his visit. Pope Benedict is 80 and doesn't have the stamina that John Paul had when he became pope, so he has limited the cities that he's going to visit to the United States. But in a message last week to Americans, he said that just because he's only visiting those two cities doesn't mean that he doesn't mean to address all of America.
Now, one of the pope's agenda items is to speak to people of many faiths here in the United States and to express a certain solidarity and tolerance for those faiths. Also, there's the sex scandal in the Catholic Church. Is there any way that he's going to be directly confronted with any of that on this visit?
Well, his advisors and Vatican officials have been saying that he's going to address the sexual abuse scandal. There's a couple different places that he could do that, but it would be highly unlikely that he would come to the United States. This is the first papal visit since the scandal, and not have something to say about it. One of the questions, though, is whether he's going to meet with victims of the scandal. We've had mixed messages on that. Victims groups have, sent messages to him saying, "Please sit down with us. Please have an understanding of what we've gone through." And it's not clear whether that's going to happen.
Have you bookmarked watchthepope.com, Laurie?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, you can actually, the Vatican is really sort of exploiting the kind of online presence of the pope. You can actually watch the pope through the visit here to the United States, and you can literally download a pattern to make your own miter hat.
There's also been a skateboard contest in the Archdiocese of New York. They tried to involve young people by having them design a skateboard for Pope Benedict. I mean, what you see here is the efforts on the part of the church to evangelize a younger generation and to reach out through through new media.
I love that. Have you visited the skateboarding contest?
Well, they actually have. You're able to go and vote online for your favorite design.
Oh, that's great. We should get a camera up to the skateboard contest. Anyway, Laurie, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Laurie Goodstein will be following Pope Benedict's visit in the New York Times.
There's a point to this song, isn't there?
Benny and the Jets?
Benny and the Jets.
I
Pope Benedict. I didn't quite get that earlier this morning, but
now
I get it.
Hey, kids, shake it loose together. The spotlight's hitting something that's been known to change the weather.
Femi, okay. What's happening in the world? You got some other headlines for us, don't you?
I certainly do. Good morning. I'm going to take you over to Kenya, where Kenyans are celebrating. They finally have a power-sharing deal after violently disputed elections, which go back all the way to December. President Mwai Kibaki named his opposition leader, Raila Odinga, prime minister on Sunday. The agreement resolves a political crisis that has left more than 1,200 people dead. Asian and European markets are down today following Wall Street's tumble late last week on concerns over a slowdown in the US economy and the outlook for corporate profits. And John, are you paying attention? You sent me some homework.
I did, yes. What's the ticket price?
$8.
$8 from Dakar?
That's a lot of money, isn't it? Not for me personally, but if I was in
that's
Calcutta.
That's a lot of money.
It's expensive.
It's Dakar to where?
To Calcutta.
And that's just one way.
One way.
So it's
which
16.
Which makes it 16.
That's not inexpensive.
You get change back from
You're
your pen
on
there.
Today.
Yeah.
Let me, for our listeners who've just joined us, let's just play them this train that's moving from Calcutta to Dakar. It's the first time since 1965 that the train surface has been on, and that was due to a war between India and Pakistan back in the 60s.
But just to show you how like screwed up my geography is, I thought you said to Calcutta to Dakar. Okay, so that's a much bigger ride. It's a much bigger train ride.
And it would involve a ferry, I presume.
I would think, yes, it would. Water. No, I looked at my map, and it would involve a ferry.
In which
so
case,
$8 is a little more reasonable.
That would be $8 heck of a trip, John.
Yeah, and $8 would be a bargain for that.
That would be a heck of a trip.
Do we have time for one more?
Yes,
no,
go.
No, we don't, actually.
We
don't have
please,
time.
Please, sir, can I have some more?
Not today.
Not today, because we want to get on to the good news that's happening in the economy.
Thanks, Femi.
Because we know there's lots of tough times, right? We know that Wall Street is hurt, and the housing and financial markets and so on, but there's one industry.
So you found a happy story?
There's one industry that's enjoying some really good times. John, you know what that is?
I believe that's something from Mario Brothers, Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, just because you read it.
No, I actually know.
It's from a video game, Super Mario Brothers. You're right. The video game industry is booming, pulling in $19 billion last year. And to put that in context, that's more than twice what Hollywood's box office brought in. Nick Chester, editor-in-chief of the gaming website, Destructoid.com, is joining us. And why is the gaming industry doing so well, Nick?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you just said, you know, they're beating Hollywood out right now. I mean, when you go see a movie, I just saw a movie last week, I think, with my kid. It cost me like $50 between, you know, three tickets, one for me, one for my wife, one for my son. Then popcorn was $25 or whatever it was. You know, for $50, I only got an hour and a half, 2 hours worth of entertainment. You go to a GameStop, you go into a Best Buy, any place like that to pick up a video game for $50, you could play it for 35, 40 hours if you wanted to.
So I got a picture of you sitting on your couch with your family playing Doom all night? Is that what you do?
Yeah, pretty much. Me and my 10-year-old son, we play Doom for 45 hours straight.
45 hours? But Nick,
story?
You probably are what most people imagine is the average gamer, right? A white male, you're a young guy, but actually it's growing in all areas. I think 38% of people who are gaming are women.
Well, yeah, it's changed a little bit. I think with the Wii, Nintendo's kind of positioned it towards a different market. You'll see a lot of older people playing video games. They were taking the Wiis into senior citizen homes and putting the Wii remotes into the hands of some non-gamers. You'll see, you know, ads in O Magazine, and you go, you know, turn on your TV and on The View and on Oprah, you'll see people playing with the Nintendo Wii.
We have a Wii takeaway game.
Oh, do you?
Yes, we do. You can actually play the game. You can actually be in our studio on Wii.
Really? How does that work exactly?
Well,
I can't wait to hear this, Nick.
I'm lying.
Yeah, he's totally
making
up.
We have the technology.
But you said something that's really interesting. Two years ago, you said when you were working at GameStop that parents were coming in and buying these games for kids, but that's no longer the case so much.
I think it's changing a little bit. It's kind of hard to say because I no longer work in GameStop anymore, but just walking in there, you'll see a lot of parents come in looking for the Wii. And what you'll hear is that they'll pretend like it's for their son or their daughter, but they're really secretly interested. They really want to play Wii Sports, and they really want to play Wii Bowling, either with the family or when everybody goes to bed. They can kind of sneak down into the basement and play by themselves. I think there's something about the Wii, the technology, and the way it kind of works that's appealing to a different kind of audience now. It's not just, you know, necessarily shooting people or jumping on people's heads. It's the interface, the whole maybe the whole exercise portion of it. Maybe people just need an excuse to move around.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Nick. In Hollywood during the Depression, it was some of the most successful years. And it sounds as though if we are going into a prolonged recession, that gaming is positioned to do what Hollywood did in the 1930s in some sense.
Yeah, I mean, that actually makes sense. If people are looking for maybe an escape or like something cheap to do. I mean, not to necessarily say gaming is cheap. It could cost anywhere from $50 to $60 to play a game. You know, but like I said, I think, you know, the perceived entertainment value of a game is a little bit different than it was a couple of years ago.
Well, thanks, Nick.
Nick Chester, real quick question for you. Have you done your taxes?
Yeah, I have. My wife handled it for me while I was playing Doom.
That's nice. Nick
Chester.
The website, I want to say it, destructoid.com.
Thank you.
All right, you're welcome, guys.
Oh, boy.
So,
I can't answer this. I have to start filling out my tax forms. That's what Jake in Cambridge says.
Jay He's Edwards says, I always put off changing the oil in my car. My procrastination finally bit me when my engine seized on the highway on my way to taking the bar exam.
Oh, yeah, that'd be bad.
Oh.
That would be so bad.
From Cape Elizabeth, Maine, Ginger's got a sense of humor. I've got to run to work, but can I email you a story later today?
That's actually quite clever, I think. When I was in college, I'd always come up with a schedule to get essays done on time. But surprise, I'd always be pulling all-nighters in the college library the night before with everyone else in my class. Well, I was good for those last-minute reports.
We're going to be procrastinating all day on thetakeaway.org. You can send us your stories. We'll get back to you. We're going to be following these stories also. President Bush getting an update on the troubles facing the airline industry during a cabinet meeting today. Final approval on the boards of Delta and Northwest to announce a merger, perhaps.
And on Friday, we heard everyone's stories about how travel changes are changing this summer because all of this airline madness. And Pope Benedict will receive a mixed welcome when he arrives in Washington for his first papal visit to the U.S. tomorrow.
I wonder if he's going to look at the skateboards.
Somehow I doubt it.
Skateboards.
As
a 81-year-old man on a skateboard?
Exactly. That would be quite a vision, right?
But he's got a 21-gun salute at the White House, so look for that.
Yeah, President Bush is planning that. It will be an interesting trip for the Pope.
Yeah, I don't know.
Has
maybe
he
it's his only. Maybe
before,
it's his only
you know?
One. No, he's never. Oh, has he ever
Pope
been here
Benedict,
in his life?
Has
That's
he ever
a good
been
question.
Here in his
That's
life.
A good question. I don't know.
We'll know that tomorrow. Then
he's
right?
been procrastinating. He's been procrastinating. He should have come years ago.
Why?
To visit us here at the Takeaway, Pope Benny. We got a mic for you here. Come on over.
The Takeaway is produced in association with the BBC World Service, the New York Times, and WGBH Boston.
PRI, Public Radio International.